Welcome to the Black Cop Podcast. The purpose of this podcast is to offer our listeners a dual perspective of members of the Black community who also serve our community as law enforcement officers through thoughtful discussion, debate, and articulation of facts with some reasonable opinions. Our communities are struggling to coexist, and I hope this podcast can serve as a bridge to help reconcile these two communities. King of the class, man. Take your crown, King. Hey, everybody. Hello. Welcome back. This episode of the Black Cop Podcast is a very special episode because we have with us the one, the only, Dr. Marlena Webster. She is a licensed clinician, clinical psychologist, and the founder of Grace Wellness Therapeutic Services. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
The wonderful, the beautiful, the graceful. Dr. Webster. It is truly a pleasure to have you on. I am grateful for your presence and your expertise. So this episode is called The Bruise with Dr. Marlena Webster, Black and Blue Trauma. And we're really trying to focus on the things that cause our communities trauma, mental illness, emotional heartache, that makes it harder for us to interact in the future, to recover, to have positive pro-social communication between us, to interact in a positive way. So, how are you doing today?
Doing well.
Good.
It's been a beautiful day, so.
You are an expert in so many fields, and you're so humble, you know what I mean? But you're a doctor, you have a phenomenal resume, but I will be obedient to your introduction that you gave me, and I will stay within those means. So I just want to get started with, just take our listeners through the concept of trauma. Like, what is trauma, and how does that affect us?
Yeah, so the actual Webster's Dictionary definition of trauma is a deeply distressing or disturbing experience. That's the, I guess, hard and fast definition. But when we think about the trauma that people experience on a day-to-day basis or sort of compounding trauma, it can look a couple of different ways. So the work that I do, I see and work with folks who experience trauma from combat or from trauma related to sexual assault. However, one type of trauma that we don't talk about as much, but I do believe is getting more recognition now, is race-based trauma. And so recognizing that race is it's a social construct. However, it becomes a part of how we identify ourselves as Black, white, and it's more so that than ethnicity, which would be your Caucasian or African American, Asian American, etc. And so I think when a part of our identity is being attacked, it can have even more of a negative impact on how we perceive ourselves and can lay the foundation for even more trauma.
Wow.
And so when we think about what folks are experiencing today, where they have this constant exposure to police violence, violence within their own communities, and negative perceptions against the Black community, I think it just can give more space for this deep distress that that captures trauma. But we want to also recognize that trauma can play out as far as the symptoms in various ways. So oftentimes we see folks are more hypervigilant or on edge.
That's the key word. We're going to come back to hypervigilance.
And then also there's often just a change in mood. sort of going along with the hypervigilance, kind of a dysthymic mood, more depressed. For some people, it can come out as anxiety. Oftentimes, folks are a bit more irritable when they are experiencing trauma, difficult time sleeping, and can have a fear of re-experiencing the trauma.
Okay, so let's pause right there. Mm-hmm. So what we covered is, we covered pretty much the definition of trauma for our for people like me who might not be as sophisticated in the field of psychology. I'm going to try to, we talked about the definition and what we understand trauma to be, and then we talked about the symptoms and the things that you might experience in your personal life, you know, in your day-to-day life that helps you understand that you may be going through some form of mental illness. Mm-hmm. So when we talk about those symptoms, and we're going to come back to hypervigilance. When you say somebody's experiencing a race-based form of trauma, like, can you give us like a real life, like a life scenario? Like, what would happen? How could that play out for somebody?
Well, so it can play out a number of ways. And a part of trauma is that it is also subjective. Mm-hmm. And so something, the same event could happen for two people and be traumatic for one person and not so much so for another person. And so we want to think about what the person's baseline is, and some people may be more or less resilient or able to bounce back from challenging experiences than others. But a race-based trauma could be discrimination. So
in that light, could police brutality and or witnessing police brutality be a form of race-based trauma?
Yes. So especially when, as we see in the media, for better or for worse, there's often a stage for police brutality in the sense of a white officer versus a black citizen. Mm-hmm. And so it's not to say that there aren't black officers who are brutal toward black citizens, or white officers who are brutal to white citizens, or Asian American, or whomever. However, it seems like right now in our country, more attention is being given to the white officer versus black citizen scenario. And so as we continue to see that over and over again, where in cases where, at least from the perception of those who are observing it from the outside, it may, it can, and it, and the perception is that this person is innocent, the citizen being, or that the situation could have been handled in a different way. And it can start to sort of sink in for people that, other people outside of my race see me as less than or not deserving of better treatment or care.
So it's like they're being dehumanized. They feel dehumanized. And then, like, when somebody who's witnessing it, they now dehumanize that person who's being dehumanized. Or so, I guess I overuse dehumanize. But, like, if that person is getting, that person observes an officer shoots a black person, that black person who may feel that situation is unjust for being shot is going to experience a level of dehumanization. And then the citizen or the witness who watches this may also see that black person is dehumanized and have a lesser amount of respect for that person?
Well, and I don't know if they have less respect for the person who in that situation may be seen as the black citizen. I can't say they'd be seen as the victim, but more so in the sense that they, an observer who is also black may start to identify with that person and almost empathize and feel the pain of what they may experience by feeling that they too have been dehumanized and seen as less than. And so it sort of, for some people, can become a shared experience. And so, but it's not only just witnessing it, but also experiencing it for themselves. And so race-based trauma can also be from folks sort of sitting on edge or being consistently fearful of being pulled over. And especially in these days where we don't know what will be the end result of being pulled over as a black person.
That's a great point. I had a traffic stop and the lady was like suspended by like five times. Right. And in places in certain states, that's an arrestable offense. Mm-hmm. But I figure I just give her a summons, you know what I mean, and let her come to court. And I tell them, like, hey, look, try to get your license or at least go to the DMV and let the judge know you're on a payment plan, because they look at that favorably, like you're trying to get it taken care of. But I really felt so bad because I got to do my job in that situation. But she was so nervous and so shaken. And she felt like she couldn't drive anymore after the traffic stop. And I felt like, you know, she would even say that, like, no, because when we came to court, she was still nervous and shaken. And the judge offered her to get a public defender. And the judge told her that we're going to continue this because the judge was concerned about her being so, like, literally shaking and nervous being in court. She just couldn't. She was just so uncomfortable. She was in tears the whole time. And so all I could think was, man, she's, you know, did I do anything to her? And then I was like, well, and then as I got older or later, I was like, maybe she experienced something that was outside of me, or maybe it was me. But I think that situation reminds me of like that trauma, anxiousness. Like she just couldn't stop shaking. And then, I just really felt bad for her. And the judge was leaning towards her, you know what I mean? But I guess her shakiness and her crying, you would identify those as like signs of that trauma.
And I imagine, like you said, we don't know what else was going on for her. And it makes me wonder if a part of her anxiousness was, one, knowing that she did have reason to actually get pulled over. And so she was already riding dirty. right. So that's a fear of, okay, if I get pulled over, then, they have clear justification to have pretty severe repercussions. Certainly not to the point of death, but
correct.
Could mean incarceration.
Yeah, and make her feel nervous.
And but then when you couple that with again, what's just been posted in the media that gets highlighted with people who are pulled over for very minor offenses or things that are not even an offense, and just from being a black person behind the wheel of a car, I can imagine that would, sort of amplify the anxiety that she experienced. Like I can say for myself, when I got pulled over recently, I was super anxious because it was also after the death of a officer. But I have, and this is, I guess, kind of shows the range of responses that people can have when they are sort of working from that. And not to say that I would say I experienced race-based trauma, but certainly anxiety from, what I've seen in the media. But my reaction was, well, let me just be as straightforward as possible and keep my hands visible. I already know what I need to do to try to make this person as comfortable as possible. So much so to the point that I didn't even share information with the officer that probably could have got me off. But I was just trying to get it over with. I was angry and felt, but again, I had a way of compartmentalizing that and just to stay as straightforward and at least probably in her perception of me as calm as possible, to not startle her any further, to put myself in any more danger.
Gotcha. That's a real thing where we feel like we have to be responsible for our emotional reactions and the officer's emotional reaction. And that dual weight kind of like weighs us down and weighs on us. And then, the person pulling it behind the gun, the person pulling the trigger, how would that impact them? Like, do you think that is, of course, it's going to have highs, like pros and cons, I guess not pros in that way, but they're going to be things that maybe don't affect them and things that do affect them. What would affect a person and that the officer in that position?
I think it's individualized to that officer. So depending on what their baseline is and what their sort of background and mindset is going into it, each of us have our own justification system. And oftentimes our justification system is set up by the experiences that we've had prior to whatever experience that we have presently. Our brain can set up what's called schema. So it's sort of like just an easy shortcut for us to have a blueprint sort of how to handle situations as they arise and to continue to address the situation that may be similar in the same way.
Gotcha.
And so, yeah, I don't think there's one particular way that the person may respond, but I think it is helpful to consider that officers are humans too. Mm. And so, though it can oftentimes seem like they're just a person in a uniform who is perhaps not as impacted by what we experience or what they're doing on a day-to-day basis, I think oftentimes they still are. And so it could be a similar piece where they have a difficult time sleeping or they have sort of flashbacks or nightmares related to the experiences that they've had or just that sort of ruminative thought or sort of cyclical thought. I get stuck in my thoughts and thinking about how could I have handled that situation differently to potentially have a different outcome. And and at the same time, there may be some folks who walk away and have absolutely no feeling about it.
Wow.
And that may be their way of being able to cope with it. So
just compartmentalize it and just put it to the back of the mind almost.
Yep. And that's one of the sort of negative consequences that have come about and from research even proven as far as the impact of people continually seeing folks killed on TV, whether it's from the recordings that folks are capturing and even from sort of the ever moving threshold of violence being shown on fictional TV.
And that's a great segue into I'll let you continue. I find myself and I hear it a lot amongst people, especially people in the Black community. It's like, you know, when someone is on another citizen, especially a Black person, is killed in an officer involved shooting and the video comes out. I didn't do this when I first started seeing these on video, but now when I see these on video, I have to actually like ask myself, like, do I want to see another shooting on video again? And I had to really, I think ultimately I end up looking at the video. But I'm wondering, like, what mental health am I sacrificing when I do that? And then because I weigh it against, like, you know, it's on camera and I have the opportunity to witness something and be a witness to something that was unjust to someone who I identify with and because of our racial designation. And it, for me, it's almost like I feel like I have to honor their death in a weird way by like looking at the video footage, even though I feel like I shouldn't, because I almost want to be able to be compassionate towards the person that was killed and have this righteous indignation towards the killer.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like that gives me the evidence to feel that way. And I feel like at the same time, like, you know, I am sacrificing little by little my mental health. What do you think about that whole scenario?
Yeah, so the research shows that we become more and more desensitized as we get more and more exposure to violence, whether it's actual real life violence or if it is the dramatized violence that can be created in movies and television shows. And that desensitization can certainly have an impact on the way that I think both police officers can view the world and experience their work, and also on the way that people from the outside can. And so when it's looking at sort of, you know, what to do with, you know, it sounds like what I'm hearing from you is almost setting boundaries for yourself when watching that. I recommend it often to, you know,
about to get this free therapy real quick.
I'll send your invoice in the mail. but we, you know, oftentimes tell folks to, you know, skip the news or to set aside for yourself just one news outlet, one news show to watch, especially if you know that it's starting to impact you. If it's starting to take a wear and tear on your just well-being and quality of life. And I think also as humans, we have this struggle with that fear of missing out. Mm-hmm. Whereas, you know, if I don't see it, I'm going to be behind on what's happening in the world, or I'm going to be in some way ignorant of the facts of, or I don't know if it's facts, but I'm going to be ignorant of the main events that are occurring in the world. And as you also said, we want to be able to empathize with these folks who are losing their lives, or some way being brutalized by folks who are supposed to be in authority. Mm-hmm. And so, but I think it's looking at what your values are and, you know, sort of letting that to guide what it is that you do. So do you value having peace of mind more, or do you value mm-hmm. knowing what's happening in the world? And, you know, I would say for myself, I value peace of mind. And so, yeah, there are nights I skip the news, or I only limit it to one news show, and that's enough. Yeah. And the same is true for social media. So I'm learning to cut ourselves off from that. And that can take us down a whole different path of the things that we can be exposed to on social media. But, you know, just a similar piece of making sure that you're protecting your peace in the midst of also wanting to be informed.
Mm. That's cool. That's great. And I think, you know, honestly, I mean, that's a great point. It's almost like, what is my goal, and how do I want to feel? You know what I mean? Like, and then sticking with that. And then I think also like the timeliness of it. Like if I'm exhausted at the end of my day, or if I'm already stressed out from something, that's probably not the best time to look at it. And I, you know, a part of me is almost, I think I will be more likely to look at it and just deal with the peace of mind piece. Mm-hmm. But as I grow and mature in that, knowing what's my boundaries, I think that there are going to have to be times where I just say, you know what, I'm just going to take everybody's word for it. Cause it's not like I'm a lawyer or adjudicating the case myself. You know what I mean? And I think that really helps and makes a difference. So like, yeah, if I read your resume correctly, you have a background with working with children, correct?
Yes.
Could you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. So before going into my work with adults, as a clinical psychologist, I was a school psychologist. Mm. And yeah, kids, the impact that this has on kids, I don't think we even know the full extent of it at this point.
Hey, that's exactly where I was going with this. He's just ahead of the game. I'm just going to ask the question just for the sake of setting it up. But what do you perceive the impact of this on kids, and how do we as parents, especially parents in the Black community or parents in general, explain these events to our children?
Yeah. So as far as the impact that it's having on kids, I don't think kids are very different from us as adults in the sense of the desensitization to violence. And so it unfortunately can just become just another thing that we see. Wow. Where we can lose that the empathy for other people and just see them as things on a screen. And you know, for kids, this can play out in the way that they interact with one another, where they're less sensitive to the needs of their playmates or their classmates, their siblings, and it can impact them with their social emotional functioning.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if you see someone who is, you know, in your mind and what you've been taught is supposed to protect you and is supposed to be the person that you go to for help, however, you're seeing that this person is killing someone who has the same skin color as you. And
that's how I identify with them.
Yeah. And so why would I go to trust this person? Mm-hmm. Why would I believe that they're going to help me when I'm in need?
And I have this subjective race-based trauma, and I'm therefore believing that it impacts me.
Yeah. And some kids can start to internalize that I'm less than because obviously this person on TV is treating this other human being who looks like me as if they are an animal or not even the way that we treat animals here in the United States is better than we treat Black people sometimes. So, yeah. You know, but in the mind of a child, it may be, you know, they're treating them like something that can easily be discarded. And that doesn't have a soul or emotions or a family to go home to as well. Mm. And so I think it's very important for parents to monitor what their children are being exposed to. And so it may be that you excuse your child from the room when you turn on the news, or even waiting to watch the news until after your children have gone to bed. But also being cognizant that you do have to let your children know, especially, you know, our little brown children, and especially our little brown boys, that unfortunately, you may not be given the same grace as children who don't look like you.
Wow.
And so, but finding a way to explain that where they recognize that it's not about who they are. It's about the misperceptions of other people, and recognizing that we can't change what other people do or say. We can only change our behavior and the way that we present ourselves, and also set boundaries for ourselves. And so I think it's sort of flipping on its head, this piece that some parents feel like, I shouldn't have to have a quote unquote the talk with my kids about how to behave out in public, or how to respond if pulled over. Well, it's also, yeah, it would be nice to not have to do that. And it's also, well, we can get out ahead of it and sort of shape the narrative for ourselves for how we want our children to interact in those situations. And so it's sort of taking as a sense of, I have power and I can empower my child in a way where they can respond in a way that allows them to come home alive.
You know, when I was a kid, I probably was like fourth grade, I had got allowance, you know, and did something and or worked or did something. I got money from somewhere. And we went to the toy store, and I bought me this really nice black and brown handgun. Like, it was a toy handgun, of course. It was a toy handgun, and it just made me feel like the superhero. I'm playing with this gun all day and all night. And so I go outside one day, and I'm playing with this toy gun. Now, we, you know, the toy guns, they got the little orange tips on them, so you know they're a toy. And I'm outside at the apartment complex in the field playing with this toy gun. And I guess my mom drove past and saw me outside playing. So she gets in the house and she calls me inside from the window, as my mother does. And she was like, give me the gun. I gave her the gun and she was like, go back outside. And that was the last time I saw that gun. And so when I came back and I was looking for the gun, I said, I asked her what happened to the gun. And she was like, some police officer is going to drive by and think that you have a gun that you're shooting at somebody, and I don't know how they're going to respond to you. So what she did in return, she bought me this, like, and it was still a cool gun. It was like a RoboCop Desert Eagle gun, but it was like lime green with orange tip. The whole thing was lime green with orange tip. So it looked like a mix of it was a Nerf gun, but it still looked like a RoboCop Desert Eagle. She was like, you can play with this. And so, like, that was one of those, like, moments that kind of helped me realize, like, even though I don't identify as a criminal or identify as someone who is going to do harm to, you know, a police officer or anything like that, I have to respect and realize that people are going to respond to me in ways that I can't control. Like just because I look a certain way, they're going to assume that they need to respond to me in that way. And so I think you bring a good point. It's like, you know, we gotta have that talk with the kids. We gotta let them know, like, hey, this is, even though you don't want to be held to this stigma, and it's also kind of goes your point, like, you know, I don't want a kid who has nothing to do with any crime. I don't want them to wear like be outside at night, all times of night, wearing like an all black hoodie and all black clothing. Like, to me, that just going to put yourself at risk to be assumed to be doing something wrong. And no, yes, you shouldn't have to change how you dress according to how people respond to you. And yes, you shouldn't have to figure out, what can I wear so that people aren't threatened by me? But the reality is that you can't control how people respond to you. And wearing that hoodie is almost like, you know, so if somebody, you know, and as being a, you know, coming from a law enforcement background, a lot of descriptions of suspects are wearing all black. You know what I mean? It's probably black male wearing all black. Well, you just happen to be walking to your friend's house or walking from the basketball court or to the store or whatever, from the football field, whatever you're doing. I don't know, robotics contest, whatever you're doing. But now all of a sudden you're putting yourself at risk. And so I 100% agree with you and totally agree with you. So question. So kids, adults, all the same. We have to explain this to them. How do we heal from looking at from the trauma? Or how do we like try to rehabilitate from the trauma of looking at these videos or being a part of these race-based police experiences? And yeah, I'll stay with this. We'll see what that.
I think talking about it can be healing within itself. And whether it's talking to other people who have shared experiences or talking to people who, you know, may seem to be on the quote unquote other side of it, to sort of find common ground. I don't think that's a mandatory piece, because I also don't want people to feel like you have to do X, Y, Z with other people that you already feel threatened by. Mm-hmm. So I think do what fits within your comfort zone. But I absolutely support people going to therapy to talk about it, because...
Especially Grace Wellness Therapy.
Yes. yeah, I just think that there's power in being able to sit with someone that you may not know very well, and whose main job is to just support you in your journey to healing, and recognizing that you're the one who gets to do the work, but you get to have someone who is ushering you along the way. And so in a space that is without judgment and supportive and compassionate, which we cannot expect to always get from our family, our friends, our partners.
Yeah, who probably don't know how to respond to us, too, in a healthy way.
Correct. And they're dealing with their own stuff. Mm-hmm. And they have, some people have not dealt with their own stuff to be able to then help someone else to heal. Mm-hmm. You know, if you're someone who likes to sort of write about it, that can certainly be a way. Using creative means to express the emotion that you have around it. But I think there's just really a lot of power in talking to other people about it, because oftentimes we can be in experiences and feel like we're alone, and think that no one else can understand or no one else gets where we're coming from. And so when we go to support groups or, you know, just again, talk to other people about it, we get to recognize that, okay, this is a shared experience, and albeit it may be an unfortunate shared experience, is one that we recognize is not just me doing it by myself.
Yeah.
And so I think that, though, you know, therapy is a relatively easy way, though it's not always affordable, which is its own separate conversation, because that, you know, the very communities that need it oftentimes can be quote unquote locked out of it because of cost or insurance prices, and there's a sense of stigma. So to think about someone, to think about yourself as having a quote unquote mental illness, you know, it's hard to wrap our minds around it. I don't think everything that people experience that is traumatic necessarily has to be categorized as a mental illness, and it's still traumatic. And so, you know, because oftentimes the things that we experience that bring on some of this distress, these are atypical situations. It should not be everyday run of the mill to see someone die from having a knee on their neck. Whether or not something else was happening for the person, that should not be something that, oh, I just get used to. Yeah. Or it should not be something that we get used to hear that 20 students have been killed by one of their classmates. And thank God we haven't had any of that happen in this year, partly because kids are not even in the school building. But I think those are situations that we as a nation have become very accustomed to hearing, unfortunately. But they are still atypical situations, and it is okay and typical to have responses to an atypical situation. So it would be concerning if we didn't feel more distressed, if we didn't feel more on edge, if we didn't have more challenges with sleeping, after seeing time and time again somebody being murdered or somebody being treated unjustly for their skin color, for their sexual orientation, for them just being who they are. I think that understanding helps to break down some of the stigma and to recognize that anybody can benefit from therapy. But again, it's also giving space and opportunity for people to actually have access to it.
Wow. That was awesome. Thank you for that. That was really good. This is Dr. Marlena Webster, folks. She's batting 1,000. I liken watching these videos and people experiencing these videos to almost like watching a movie about another movie about slavery. That's one thing I'm just tired of seeing. Honestly, unless it's teaching me something about history or unless it's taking my knowledge to another level, I just don't want to see the brutality of slavery on a movie right now. I mean, I think we got enough movies, got enough references. I don't want to see it. And I guess that's the same way I feel like I see police brutality. But I also want to say that not every police interaction leads to police brutality. And there are good police officers out there. There are guys and girls who do genuinely care about citizens in their communities, who genuinely are not trying to cause the trauma or damage, who some may even be cognitive of it and are wanting to limit the likelihood of someone having that trauma or that damage occur in their lives. And I think that a lot of times the damage that people experience from police officers doesn't have to be with police brutality. It can be where there was a domestic, and a child or something witnesses how an officer has to detain or take into arrest the abusive parent. It could be when someone is in a foot pursuit and their friend who's living a different lifestyle gets chased by police, and their friend now probably has a negative perspective of police, and that's who they interact with. So their perspective of police may come from their friend. There's also this element of policing when it comes to solving crimes. Hey, you didn't arrest the killer of my relative. Now I have this negative experience with police, or I didn't get the service I want, or maybe I expected charges to be taken that weren't taken. And I think also something else that happens that isn't directly police brutality, but can lead to a negative experience with police is crime scenes, where, say someone is killed and some neighborhood, especially a project housing or a rough neighborhood where they know people and people know them, and that person is killed, and the medics come out on scene and they determine that this person is DOA. That person is dead on arrival. Well, now this person is not moved. They're going to lay the sheet over the person. They're going to put up some barrier so you can't directly see the person. But it's something about that person still being on the ground during the course of that investigation that seems to really have the most, I would assume, significant amount of trauma, because the reactions are so strong. And you got your crime scene techs out here, going through the parking lots, taking pictures, doing their jobs, and it takes time. Then you have to have a body removal service come and pick the person up and transport them back to the medical examiner's office. And while that process is occurring, you have people outside witnessing this person on the ground. And the question is why aren't you getting them off the ground? Why is this person still there? Why aren't they providing the right assistance that me as a citizen or the friend or the witness of this incident feel like this should be had? What is the trauma of, I guess it's similar, but what do you think about the situation where someone is witnessing a body on the ground and it just seems to fuel this anger towards police? What do you think about that?
It's a lot to see someone that you love lying there on the ground. I think it makes it very real, and that they are unfortunately not coming back from this. I can imagine that people who are there seeing, perhaps even they may have seen what actually happened to the person. They want you as the first responder to do everything you can to bring their person back. And so y'all end up getting the heat as the, you're not doing enough when there's not anything else that can be done. And so, you know, I would imagine that the goal would be to get the body out there as quickly as possible. Because as it lingers, again, it makes it set in longer and longer for folks. And I think also it helps to, for it, not help, but it allows people to see sort of the behind the curtain of what really happens in these situations. Where, you know, when you see a clip on the news, it's just so-and-so was shot, you know, X, Y, Z. They may show the outline of the body, but you're typically not going to see the body itself on the news. And so I think there's this contrast of perhaps what they expect to happen versus what the reality of it is. And so, and it causes, you know, for some people it can cause this cognitive dissonance that, oh, I think this should be happening, but this is what I'm seeing occurring. And I want them to do more. Or even for myself, I want to be able to do more to help this person that I loved, or for some people, I didn't even know this person, but I feel this connection to them because I'm here and seeing them lying here on the ground, dead.
It's almost like something deep in us. It's almost, you know, spiritual, biblical. Like there's something deep when we see blood, we see the body on the ground. It's just, it's, there's an internal compelling, you know, like you might not know the person, you might not know what's going on, how they got there, but it's almost like, man, like it grabs my attention. At the least, and then how I respond to giving what I feel after I give it my attention is, I guess, dependent on the person.
Yeah, that's I think that's deep, and it can certainly go a whole bunch of different directions. But I think it goes back to that portion I mentioned earlier, as far as that shared experience, and it's sort of the other end of that shared experience where it's not just that, you know, I saw this recording of what happened to this person and it makes me feel like because I look like this person, that I'm less valued, just as perhaps they were in that moment. But now it's, well, I identify with this person as them looking like me, and I want somebody to do for this person in the same way that I would want them to do for me if I were lying on the ground.
That is awesome. I think we're like, you know, want to love them the way we want to be loved in a way. And so it's like, let me, you know, make sure this person gets this justice, because I hope that if I'm in that situation, somebody's going to make sure I get this justice. That's deep.